Coming up.
Today we honour the Indigenous peoples of this land.
Should you feel guilty about a wrong committed by someone else in your family?
What about an ancestor you never even knew?
We apologise for the mistreatment of those who were stolen generations. This blemished chapter in our national history. How can we dance when our earth is burning?
How do we sleep while our beds are burning? Why should I feel guilty for the wrongs my great-grandfather committed against your great-grandfather?
There's a power in acknowledging a mistake so that together we can continue to perfect our union.
Aren't I responsible only for myself and myself alone?
Our guest is Larry May from Vanderbilt University.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin over at Stanford University, where Ken and I hang around Philosopher's Corner.
Today, we're discussing moral taint and collective responsibility as we ask, can we be tainted by the sins of our fathers?
Of course we can, and of our mothers, too. Adam and Eve ate that apple, remember, and tainted all of humankind with original sin.
Yeah, you know, John, but I know that's the biblical theory, but frankly, I don't get it. I never have gotten it. They ate the apple, not us. Why does God hold us responsible for what they did?
Well, it's not just the Bible and the somewhat impenetrable mind of God. It's also the law, Ken. A parent allows his underage kid to drive the car. The kid gets in a crash and injures some people. Whom do you think they're going to sue?
Well, but underage children, that's a special case, John. I get that one. Special case, though.
Okay, you're an employer. One of your managers barters promotions for sexual favors. You, as his employer, can be sued for his actions.
Well, that's another special case. The law regards managers as agents of their employers. Well, when somebody else is directly acting as my agent on my authority, sure, I can be held responsible for what they do. But so what about that? That doesn't mean anything.
So what? So your simple-minded principle is slowly getting whittled down to nothing?
Well, no, I disagree. We talked about a few special cases, but otherwise, it's pretty straightforward. A person cannot, should not be held responsible for anybody's actions except his or her own.
Well, what about this? Your country invades some faraway land, seizes their oil fields, and installs a puppet government to do its bidding. Given that hypothetical, how would you feel?
Well, I'd be pretty outraged. I know what you're thinking about. I'd be outraged. Maybe I'd also, frankly, be ashamed of my country.
Aha, ashamed. Would you feel ashamed if it were Russia doing the invading?
Well, I'd still strongly disapprove, that's for sure. No doubt about it. But ashamed? No, I wouldn't feel ashamed. That seems inappropriate somehow.
Yeah, because you're not a Russian, so you bear no responsibility whatsoever for what Russia does.
I bear no responsibility whatsoever for what the U.S. does, John.
Well, and who does?
Well, the people who determine and carry out its policies, that's who.
Well, how about ordinary citizens who condone and support its policies?
Well, yeah, okay, maybe them too, maybe, at least to a certain extent, I grant you that.
How about people who are secretly disapprove of the policies, but are too afraid or lazy to openly resist?
Gee, gosh, to some extent, I want to hold them responsible, but even they are only responsible for what they themselves actually did or didn't do. Their failure to speak up when they might have. That doesn't make them responsible for the crimes that their nation ended up committing. So my principle still holds. You're only responsible for what you yourself do.
Well, I'm not so sure. Even if there's nothing that a person actually does or fails to do, I think they can still bear some degree of responsibility.
I don't see how. You're just making that up.
Well, here's another hypothetical. Suppose that for several centuries, my ancestors held your ancestors in slavery. Mine got richer and richer. Yours got poorer and poorer. One day the slaves are finally freed, but for decades, maybe even centuries after, the descendants of the slaves are much worse off than the descendants of the slaveholders.
You think that just because you benefited from that sorry history and I was harmed by that history, you and your brethren owe reparations. That's what you think to me and my brethren, even if you guys aren't actively oppressing us guys anymore. Is that what you think?
Well, I'm not exactly saying I want to pay you reparations, Ken, but I'm not so sure it wouldn't be a just thing to do. I'm just saying that the issue's a lot more complicated than you were first making it out to be.
You know, John, I see that there's definitely a lot to think about here.
Well, to give us even more food for thought, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Natalie Jones, to take a look at the reparations movement in America. She files this report.
A few months ago, the African American reparations movement got a huge public boost. The Atlantic magazine ran a cover story called The Case for Reparations.
Anytime you say the word reparations, people think you're talking about people who are long dead. But in fact, they're people who are alive, who have been disadvantaged and injured by policies that were done in our name.
That's Atlantic writer Ta-Nehisi Coates on the Colbert Report. Most of his Atlantic article refers to what happened after slavery and in the not-so-distant past. Lynchings, Jim Crow laws, housing discrimination, and predatory lending. But even if some victims are still around, could reparations do anything to repair the damage? William Darity, economics professor at Duke University, believes they could.
It's partially a symbolic indication that the nation has met an obligation or a debt to a community that's been subjected to deep injustice for many, many years. But also it can provide an opportunity for trying to close the kinds of gaps or disparities that exist between blacks and the rest of the American population.
Darity says any eventual reparations program would have to be an act of Congress, which means there would have to be significant buy-in from the American public. So theoretically, it wouldn't create much resentment. But it also would not solve everything.
Do I think it would change racial attitudes across the entire population? No. But it would give the recipients of reparations an opportunity to, in some sense, purchase their way around the obstacles that might be created by those attitudes, an opportunity that they don't possess at the moment.
Why are so many people who are brown and black poor? Is it because they're stupid? No. There's no evidence for that.
Robin Kelly teaches history at UCLA.
What there is evidence for is a continuation, the perpetuation of structures of racial inequality that keep each generation in the same place.
For years, Kelly's publicly supported a reparations movement. In his opinion, the key word is movement.
The point is that the money wouldn't go to individual families to enrich them, but to create institutions that were cooperatively run, organize and envision for the purpose of liberation.
He says an ideal reparations program would benefit Americans of all races by improving education, healthcare, and social institutions.
And that's a very different idea from like 40 acres and a Lexus, you know, in the way that people sort of joke about reparations.
According to Professor Kelly, an effective program could go even further.
Once you raise the question of reparations, you also interrogate the entire system of wealth creation. And when you do that, then it forces you to rethink the whole system that exists today.
But even if you accept the idea of reparations, there are still a lot of questions, like who pays and how much.
There is an orbit of white privilege and an orbit of substantial black disadvantage that exists today.
Again, Duke Professor William Darity.
So even if individuals did not directly suffer the consequences of a phenomenon like slavery, they are experiencing the advantages and disadvantages that were produced by those conditions.
U.S. reparations are not a new idea. In the 80s and 90s, the government paid reparations to Japanese Americans put in internment camps during World War II. But that was a much smaller group, around 80,000. And reparations were only available to people who were imprisoned themselves, not their descendants. The scope and complexity of reparations to blacks makes it even more of a controversial issue.
Japanese Americans are not the same flashpoint for antagonism that black Americans are.
It's a tough conversation that raises tough questions about privilege and responsibility. But as Atlantic writer Ta-Nehisi Coates says,
"Oh, I think it's our history, and I do think it's necessary to bum people out sometimes to heal people."
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Natalie Jones.